Chapter 13. When Mr. Goodchild had looked out of the Lancaster Inn window for 2 hours on end, with great perseverance, he began to entertain a misgiving that he was growing industrious. He therefore set himself next to explore the country from the tops of all the steep hills in the neighborhood. He came back at dinner time, red and glowing, to tell Thomas Idle what he had seen. Thomas, on his back reading, listened with great composure, and asked him whether he really had gone up those hills, and bothered himself with those views, and walked all those miles? Because I want to know, added Thomas, what he would say of it, if he were obliged to do it? It would be different then, said Francis. It would be work then. Now, it's play. Play. Replied Thomas Idle, utterly repudiating the reply. Play. Here is a man goes systematically tearing himself to pieces, and putting himself through an incessant course of training, as if he were always under articles, to fight a match for the champion's belt, and he calls it play. Play. Exclaimed Thomas Idle, scornfully contemplating his one boot in the air. You can't play. You don't know what it is. You make work of everything. The bright good child amiably smiled. So you do, said Thomas. I mean it. To me you are an absolutely terrible fellow. You do nothing like another man. Where another fellow would fall into a footpath of action or emotion, you fall into a mine. Where any other fellow would be a painted butterfly, you are a fiery dragon. Where another man would stake a sixpence, you stake your existence. If you were to go up in a balloon, you would make for heaven, and if you were to dive into the depths of the earth, nothing short of the other place would content you. What a fellow you are, Francis! The cheerful good child laughed. It's all very well to laugh, but I wonder you don't feel it to be serious, said Idle. A man who can do nothing by halves appears to me to be a fearful man. Returned Goodchild, if I can do nothing by halves, and be nothing by halves, it's pretty clear that you must take me as a whole, and make the best of me. With this philosophical rejoinder, the airy Goodchild clapped Mr. Idle on the shoulder in a final manner, and they sat down to dinner. By the by, said Goodchild, I have been over a lunatic asylum too, since I have been out. Exclaimed Thomas Idle, casting up his eyes, over a lunatic asylum. Not content with being as great an ass as Captain Barclay in the pedestrian way, he makes a lunacy commissioner of himself for nothing. An immense place, said Goodchild, admirable offices, very good arrangements, very good attendance, altogether a remarkable place. And what did you see there? Asked Mr. Idle, adapting Hamlet's advice to the occasion, and assuming the virtue of interest, though he had it not. The usual thing, said Francis Goodchild, with a sigh. Long groves of blighted men and women trees, interminable avenues of hopeless faces, numbers, without the slightest power of really combining for any earthly purpose, a society of human creatures who have nothing in common, but that they have all lost the power of being humanly social with one another. Take a glass of wine with me, said Thomas Idle, and let us be social. In one gallery, Tom, pursued Francis Goodchild, which looked to me about the length of the long walk at Windsor, more or less probably less, observed Thomas Idle. In one gallery, which was otherwise clear of patients, for they were all out, there was a poor little dark-chinned, meager man, with a perplexed brow and a pensive face, stooping low over the matting on the floor, and picking out with his thumb and forefinger the course of its fibers. The afternoon sun was slanting in at the large end window, and there were cross patches of light and shade all down the vista, made by the unseen windows and the open doors of the little sleeping cells on either side. In about the center of the perspective, under an arch, regardless of the pleasant weather, regardless of the solitude, regardless of approaching footsteps, was the poor little dark-chinned, meager man, poring over the matting. "What are you doing there?" said my conductor, when we came to him. He looked up, and pointed to the matting. "I wouldn't do that, I think," said my conductor, kindly. "If I were you, I would go and read, or I would lie down, if I felt tired. But I wouldn't do that." The patient considered a moment, and vacantly answered, "No, sir, I won't. I'll go and read," and so he lamely shuffled away into one of the little rooms. I turned my head, before we had gone many paces. He had already come out again, and was again poring over the matting, and tracking out its fibers with his thumb and forefinger. I stopped to look at him, and it came into my mind that probably the course of those fibers as they plaited in and out, over and under, was the only course of things in the whole wide world, that it was left to him to understand, that his darkening intellect had narrowed down to the small cleft of light which showed him, this piece was twisted this way, went in here, passed under, came out there, was carried on the way here to the, right where I now put my finger on it, and in this progress of events, the thing was made, and came to be here. Then, I wondered whether he looked into the matting, next, to see if it could show him anything of the process through which he came to be there, so strangely poring over it. Then, I thought how all of us, God help us, in our different ways are poring over our bits of matting, blindly enough, and what confusions and mysteries we make in the pattern. I had a sadder fellow feeling with the little dark-chinned, meager man, by that time, and I came away. Apostrophe, Mr. Idle diverting the conversation to grouse, custards, and bride cake, Mr. Goodchild followed in the same direction. The bride cake was as bilious and indigestible, as if a real bride had cut it, and the dinner it completed was an admirable performance. The house was a genuine old house of a very quaint description, teeming with old carvings, and beams, and panels, and having an excellent old staircase, with a gallery or upper staircase, cut off from it by a curious fencework of old oak, or of the old Honduras mahogany wood. It was, and is, and will be, for many a long year to come, a remarkably picturesque house, and a certain grave mystery lurking in the depth of the old mahogany panels, as if they were so many deep pools of dark water such, indeed, as they had been much among when they were trees gave it a very mysterious character after nightfall. When Mr. Goodchild and Mr. Idle at first alighted at the door, and stepped into the somber, handsome old hall, they had been received by half a dozen noiseless old men in black, all dressed exactly alike, who glided up the stairs with the obliging landlord and waiter, but without appearing to get into their way, or to mind whether they did, or no, and who had filed off to the right, and left on the old staircase, as the guests entered their sitting room. It was then broad bright day. But, Mr. Goodchild had said, when their door was shut, "Who on earth are those old men?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, and afterwards, both on going out and coming in, he had noticed that there were no old men to be seen. Neither had the old men, or any one of the old men, reappeared since. The two friends had passed a night in the house, but had seen nothing more of the old men. Mr. Goodchild, in rambling about it, had looked along passages, and glanced in at doorways, but had encountered no old men, neither did it appear that any old men were, by any member of the establishment, Mr. expected. Another odd circumstance impressed itself on their attention. It was, that the door of their sitting room was never left untouched for a quarter of an hour. It was opened with hesitation, opened with confidence, opened a little way, opened a good way, all was clapped to again without a word of explanation. They were reading, they were writing, they were eating, they were drinking, they were talking, they were dozing. The door was always opened at an unexpected moment, and they looked towards it, and it was clapped to again, and nobody was to be seen. When this had happened 50 times or so, Mr. Goodchild had said to his companion, jestingly, I begin to think, Tom, there was something wrong with those six old men. Night had come again, and they had been writing for 2 or 3 hours. Writing, in short, a portion of the lazy notes from which these lazy sheets are taken. They had left off writing, and glasses were on the table between them. The house was close and quiet. Around the head of Thomas Idle, as he lay upon his sofa, hovered light wreaths of fragrant smoke. The temples of Francis Goodchild, as he leaned back in his chair, with his two hands clasped behind his head, and his legs crossed, were similarly decorated. They had been discussing several idle subjects of speculation, not omitting the strange old men, and were still so occupied, when Mr. Goodchild abruptly changed his attitude, to wind up his watch. They were just becoming drowsy enough to be stopped in their talk by any such slight check. Thomas Idle, who was speaking at the moment, paused and said, How goes it? Said Goodchild. As if he had ordered one old man, and the order were promptly executed, truly, all orders were so, in that excellent hotel, the door opened, and one old man stood there. He did not come in, but stood with the door in his hand. One of the six, Tom, at last. Said Mr. Goodchild, in a surprised whisper. Sir, your pleasure? Said the one old man. I didn't ring. The bell did. Said the one old man. He said bell, in a deep, strong way, that would have expressed the church bell. I had the pleasure, I believe, of seeing you, yesterday? Said Goodchild. I cannot undertake to say for certain, was the grim reply of the one old man. I think you saw me? Did you not? Saw you? Said the old man. Oh yes, I saw you. But, I see many who never see me. A chilled, slow, earthy, fixed old man. A cadaverous old man of measured speech. An old man who seemed as unable to wink as if his eyelids had been nailed to his forehead. An old man whose eyes, two spots of fire, had no more motion than if they had been connected with the back of his skull by screws driven through it, and riveted and bolted outside, among his gray hair. The night had turned so cold, to Mr. Goodchild's sensations, that he shivered. He remarked lightly, and half apologetically, I think somebody is walking over my grave. Said the weird old man, there is no one there. Mr. Goodchild looked at Idle, but Idle lay with his head enwrapped in smoke. No one there? Said Goodchild. There is no one at your grave, I assure you, said the old man. He had come in, and shut the door, and he now sat down. He did not bend himself to sit, as other people do, but seemed to sink bolt upright, as if in water, until the chair stopped him. My friend, Mr. Idle, said Goodchild, extremely anxious to introduce a third person into the conversation. I am, said the old man, without looking at him, at Mr. Idle's service. If you are an old inhabitant of this place, Francis Goodchild resumed. Yes. Perhaps you can decide a point my friend and I were in doubt upon, this morning. They hang condemned criminals at the castle, I believe. I believe so, said the old man. Are their faces turned towards that noble prospect? Your faces turned, replied the old man, to the castle wall. When you are tied up, you see its stones expanding and contracting violently, and a similar expansion and contraction seem to take place in your own head and breast. Then, there is a rush of fire and an earthquake, and the castle springs into the air, and you tumble down a precipice. Apostrophe, his cravat appeared to trouble him. He put his hand to his throat, and moved his neck from side to side. He was an old man of a swollen character of face, and his nose was immovably hitched up on one side, as if by a little hook inserted in that nostril. Mr. Goodchild felt exceedingly uncomfortable, and began to think the night was hot, and not cold. A strong description, sir, apostrophe he observed. A strong sensation, apostrophe the old man rejoined. Again, Mr. Goodchild looked to Mr. Thomas Idle, but Thomas lay on his back with his face attentively turned towards the one old man, and made no sign. At this time Mr. Goodchild believed that he saw threads of fire stretch from the old man's eyes to his own, and there attach themselves.
Mr. Goodchild writes the present account of his experience, and, with the utmost solemnity, protests that he had the strongest sensation upon him of being forced to look at the old man along those two fiery films, from that moment.
I must tell it to you, apostrophe said the old man, with a ghastly and a stony stare. What? Apostrophe asked Francis Goodchild. You know where it took place? Yonder. Apostrophe, whether he pointed to the room above, or to the room below, or to any room in that old house, or to a room in some other old house in that old town, Mr. Goodchild was not, nor is, nor ever can be, sure. He was confused by the circumstance that the right forefinger of the one old man seemed to dip itself in one of the threads of fire, light itself, and make a fiery start in the air as it pointed somewhere. Having pointed somewhere, it went out. You know she was a bride, apostrophe said the old man. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.